Good evening. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters on Red River Radio. You know, it's no mystery that with age, our bodies are going to change. Some of these changes are the result of falling levels of these so-called reproductive hormones. In women, this hormonal change is widely known as menopause. In men, hormonal changes occur too, and the term andropause has emerged. This is a live show, and that means we will take your calls and comments at 1-800-552-8502. We have three guests tonight who graciously joined us for Health Matters. We have Dr. James Barrow, Clinical Assistant Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology here at the Louisiana State University School of Medicine in Shreveport. We have Ms. Tammy Herkey, a nurse practitioner here with the Menopause and Hormone Specialty Center here in Shreveport. And welcome back to Dr. Lauren Smith, a urologist with urology at Piermont, part of the Willis-Knighton Health System. Again, this is Health Matters on Red River Radio. I'm your host tonight. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. And you can call us with your questions at 1-800-552-8502. Or if you'd like to tweet a question, at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Barrow, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
You know, the hormones are sexual hormones as well as reproductive hormones. There are a number of those that are important, especially in women. I know you're an obstetrician. What are those hormones and how do they function over the lifetime of a woman?
The main hormones are estrogen and progesterone, and to a lesser extent in women, testosterone. Estrogen and progesterone are produced out throughout the reproductive life of a woman, and the sole purpose of those hormones during that reproductive life is to prepare the uterus for implantation of a viable pregnancy and maintain that pregnancy.
So these hormones basically serve to maintain a woman's reproductive health during her lifetime.
Correct.
And so as these hormones fluctuate during the course of a woman's lifetime, there are going to be certain changes that a woman will experience. Are there changes that are characteristic during the normal reproductive cycle that are more estrogen dominant versus progesterone dominant?
During the estrogen dominant portion of the phase, women can experience like breast tenderness and things like that. The progesterone portion of the menstrual cycle, typically the end of that signifies the menstrual cycle, and those are sort of the two big symptoms that patients will notice.
Okay, thank you so much. Dr. Smith, thank you so much for coming back here with Health Matters on Red River Radio.
I appreciate you having me here.
So Dr. Barrow mentioned testosterone in women. I think that's a hormone that's important for men as well, right?
I think most of us would agree that as a true statement.
Yeah, so what role does testosterone play for men?
I'm going to say that testosterone kind of makes us who we are. Over the course of a man's lifetime, it allows him to go through puberty with all the associated changes, testicular volume increase, body hair, facial hair changes, muscle mass changes, deepening the voice, things along those lines. Testosterone is obviously a very hot topic these days, and there's a lot of discussion about the benefits of having testosterone replacement. But it does have a lot of very significant changes, or create a lot of significant changes over the course of a lifetime.
Are there other reproductive hormones that are important for men? Do men have estrogen and progesterone and other reproductive hormones as well?
There are, but we don't really necessarily think of them as important to the same degree that testosterone is. So we may look at those in relation to testosterone levels and testosterone deficiency, rarely, if ever, will we replace estrogens in a male.
Thank you so much. Tammy, thank you for joining us tonight on Health Matters.
Thank you.
What is the most common symptom that you see when women come to you with hormonal complaints?
Usually when women come to me, it's not just for hot flashes and things like that. Their whole life is disrupted, but their main complaint is fatigue and to them not being able to do anything extra except their basic ADLs, and they can't do anything like they used to do.
So fatigue as well as hot flashes, or predominantly fatigue?
There's numerous symptoms. There's fatigue, depression, anxiety, vaginal dryness, muscle aches, joint aches, there's about 50 different symptoms that can be related to hormones being imbalanced or deficient.
This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. I'm your host tonight. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us. Our number for you to call, it's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Barrow, you mentioned estrogen and progesterone are important, and we're talking about the fall in these hormonal levels with age. When does menopause occur in women typically?
On average, 51 years of age.
And why does it happen? Why do women lose their ability to produce estrogen with age?
There's a finite number of follicles in each ovary that are determined in fetal life. Mm-hmm. With each menstrual cycle and each month, these follicles undergo apoptosis or regress. And when the number of these follicles get to a critical level, there's some sort of chemical switch in the brain that we don't really quite understand, and causes a cessation of hormone production.
And so these follicles, these are basically the follicles in the ovaries then that are producing eggs.
That's correct.
And so whenever these hormonal levels begin to fall with time and a woman develops symptoms, as an obstetrician gynecologist, when do you determine whether or not this is early menopause versus late menopause or normal menopause? Is it based on the woman's age?
Yes, that's correct. These symptoms are normal in the perimenopausal transition period. As Ms. Herkey explained earlier, all the symptoms that she described, and when those are close to the age of 51, say starting in the mid to late 40s, we consider that normal.
And so what determines whether or not, you know, menopause is something that women should seek attention for in terms of treating? I understand it can be somewhat controversial whether or not to, you know, bring estrogen back into a woman's life when it's falling naturally. What determines, from your standpoint, whether or not it's going to be important to re-expose that individual to estrogen or progesterone or both?
It's totally symptom-based. And the main reason that women come to see their OBGYN and seek treatment is for hot flashes.
So the hot flashes. And Tammy, when you're looking at what to treat a patient with hot flashes, estrogen is predominantly the most effective. Is that correct?
What I have found is each woman has a different hormone that's their dominant hormone. The majority is estrogen driven, but then there's some that need more progesterone than estrogen. And then I have like three that are testosterone driven and they need more testosterone than the other. But it's mainly estrogen.
Are there tests that you can perform that will determine what hormone needs to be replaced, so to speak, in a given individual?
I do. I check their follicle stimulating hormone to see if it's risen. And then I also check their hormone levels. And I have a certain range that I like to get their estrogen and progesterone if they're symptomatic. And based on symptoms, then I'll replace hormones. And then I repeat levels just to make sure the hormones aren't getting too high.
This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. You can call in tonight. It's a live show. The number is 1-800-552-8502, and the topic is falling reproductive hormones with age, known as menopause, and in men, it's known as andropause. Dr. Smith, what is andropause?
Andropause is a challenging term. It's a little bit of a misnomer.
Should I say male menopause then? Will that help you?
Yeah, I think that they're both kind of misleading because it indicates a more of a sudden drop, which is something that you do see in the female population, or a more sudden drop in the female population with menopause. Andropause, the way we're defining it really is symptoms associated with low testosterone, which often show up over time associated with a low testosterone level. The problem is we don't have a good definition of what a low testosterone level really is. I think classically we will define it as a level below 300 nanograms per milliliter, but the reality is men may have symptoms at a lower value or may have symptoms at a higher value, or the symptoms that they have may not be related to that low number. So it's a very challenging term, or a, again, sometimes a misleading term. But really what it represents is a change that's an abnormal change in physical ability that we think is related to testosterone lowering over time.
And so, I mean, that's a good point. You mentioned a number of issues there. An abnormal change, because it's normal to change.
It is, absolutely.
And so what constitutes an abnormal change? Do you follow levels over time, or do you replace and see if symptoms improve, or how do you track whether the change is physiologic or not?
Again, very difficult. I think that in my practice, I'm a symptom guy. I tend to really discuss what the men come in with in terms of their symptoms. Are they losing muscle mass? Are they depressed? Are they losing energy? They have a lack of libido or desire for intercourse. Those are really kind of the classic symptoms. I then look at their testosterone level, and we really need a morning value. Sometime between 7 and 10 o'clock in the morning is probably the best time to obtain the value, because there are surges that happen in our production early that then decrease over time. If the level is low or kind of borderline low and they have symptoms, I think it's very reasonable to treat them, see how they do, and then check a level to see where we are. If their symptoms are improving and their level is improving, then they may need to stay on the testosterone replacement. If their symptoms are not improved and we've bumped their level up, then their symptoms are likely related to something other than low testosterone.
And so if this is biological depression, so to speak, and it's not related to the normal drop in testosterone, will replacing testosterone improve a man's mood?
If his mood alteration is not due to a low testosterone level, I'm going to say the answer is no in most cases.
Right.
I assume that you can you can probably bump someone's testosterone up to an abnormally elevated level and give them symptoms of aggressiveness and other issues, but it won't solve their underlying problem.
Yeah, because depression certainly is increased in incidence in this age group. Mm-hmm. With midlife crises and things along those lines. So I could see there could be quite a bit of symptom overlap. Dr. Barrow, do you see that in women as well? Are there symptoms that overlap with, some of the more psychologically based problems that women may be going through?
Oh, yeah, of course. If you think about the average age of menopause, it's 51. So lots of women have high stress jobs. They have families. They have kids in college, high school. They're balancing family life, work life, and they're undergoing all these changes in their body. So you can imagine having disturbances in their sleep and having all these changes. And so that all definitely contributes to some of those issues as well.
This is Health Matters on Red River Radio on the topic menopause. The number is 1-800-552-8502. Tammy, we have a question. A listener was having hot flashes, estrogen tested low. Testosterone tested low normal, but she was still having hot flashes, and she was placed on Duavi.
Mm-hmm.
And is it okay? She still has periods. Is it okay to take this if she's still having periods?
The Duavi is supposed to help more of the menopausal women because it's supposed to help cease the cycle with bleeding. Did she say how old she was? I'm sorry, did I miss that?
I don't have an age.
Because I'm wondering if she might be younger than that and it might not be the right hormone for her. Because usually that one is for a perimenopausal woman who might just be cycling once in a while, and it should help cease the cycle.
49 is the age that I'm told now.
49 is the age, and if her body is still wanting to cycle, there are other options, especially if she's still hot flashing on that. I would try other things like possibly estradiol and Prometrium and work with doses on that to manage that.
Dr. Barrow, what is Duavi? What is that? Are there two hormones, would you expect someone with who's still having periods to have symptoms of menopause? Is that common?
Yes. It's the perimenopausal period. Women will actually have hot flashes, and they can have normal estrogen levels, because actually before menopause happens, you actually get an increase in FSH, as Tammy talked about earlier, and increased FSH drives estrogen production. So you can actually get a little bit of bump in estrogen in the perimenopausal period, which shows you we don't really understand the mechanism of hot flashes.
Right, right.
To begin with.
And they respond to non-estrogen treatments as well, which we'll get into, like some of the antidepressants. We have a caller. We have Eric from Alexandria. Eric, thank you for calling tonight.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question for the urologist is, I'm a 50-year-old male who has recently been put on Androgel 1.62, and I'm only a few months into it, and things, they did another blood test yesterday, and I don't know what the numbers were, but they did increase after 1 month. The testosterone numbers did increase, but one of the questions I have is, does taking a hormone therapy at my age cause my body to stop producing hormone naturally, testosterone naturally? And if so, what would happen if I stopped taking the therapy? Do I need to take it for the rest of my life?
That's a very good question, and that's a question that a lot of men battle with kind of every day who are on testosterone therapy. I'm going to break it up into a couple parts. The first is, anyone at any age who takes exogenous testosterone, which is what you're doing with the topical, is going to drop the amount that their body produces. So your body will, to some extent, become dependent on that androgel over time. And that's probably not a big deal, because as long as you're getting the level that you need and your symptoms are improving, then whether you're getting it from your testicles or whether you're putting on your skin or getting a shot or whatever administering method you use is probably okay, as long as your symptoms are improving. I'd be curious to know what the levels are, but it doesn't sound, just based on a 2 second conversation with you, that you're having any significant increase in anxiety, mood elevation, things like that, or aggressiveness. And as long as that's not the case, then you're probably on a good dose.
Okay. Well, so part of the question comes up with insurance. Insurance has been fighting me on it, and it's quite expensive without insurance. And so my concern was, if the insurance fought me on it and I wasn't able to pay for it, I stopped taking it, at what point? I mean, what's the adverse?
Am I allowed to say over the air that I hate insurance companies? Insurance companies are difficult to deal with on this problem. Actually, a number of problems when you're talking about pharmaceuticals. But with this in particular, they tend to contract with the brand name medicines, Androgel, Testim, and some of the others. Your cost as a patient can range anywhere from next to nothing to hundreds of dollars a month. And you're fighting the battle that a lot of men fight. There are other alternatives out there. Personally, I like to prescribe compounded medicines. I like to prescribe the injections, the shots. There are compounding pharmacies in your area, I'm sure, and I know in mine, that do a very good job of limiting cost and providing a very high quality medication. So there are other options out there. You should talk to your... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to cut you off. I was going to be my next question to you was... the injections, a friend of mine, similar age, similar symptoms, has gone from the Androgel to the injections. And one of the big differences, he's seeing a urologist, I'm seeing a general practitioner. So I'm actually considering going to the urologist, which I'm sure you would promote being in the field.
I'm going to promote going to the person who's going to treat you properly, and that may be a GP. I mean, you're not necessarily going to get better treatment from a urologist. I think you'll get more consistent treatment from a urologist than a GP, unless you're going to someone who does this, routinely. So there are a lot of really good general practitioners out there, and yours may or may not have a lot of experience with testosterone replacement. I think the injections are great. They're very consistent. They're fairly easy to administer. The only hassle is you have to get over the fact that you're going to stick yourself with a needle, and that can be uncomfortable.
It's great to hear that affirmation of the injection, and I think I'll pursue a urologist after this.
Sounds good.
Eric, thank you so much for calling us tonight. We have Steve.
Yes, good evening. How are you doing?
We're well. Thanks for calling Health Matters.
Thanks for having me. I'm a 58-year-old male, and in the last year, I've been experiencing some decline in my muscle mass, and I've actually experienced some weight loss that I didn't expect. And I went to a general practitioner and told him my issues, and he sent me to have some blood work to have my testosterone checked, and it was about a 160. And he said the same thing that you were saying, you know, that there's not a real number, but you like to see it around 300. And he prescribed a topical for me, and when I went home and I started watching TV, and I was watching the commercials about the creams that they've got out now that people are having issues with blood clots and strokes and that type of thing. And it made me very concerned because I have AFib, and I didn't know, and I don't know what's out there that's safe, and is there any of them that are guaranteed safe, or what kind of risk do you take by taking the topicals or any type of testosterone as far as that goes with the person that has my condition?
Sure. Well, I want to thank you for opening up that can of worms and tell you that if I had the answers, I probably wouldn't be here in Shreveport on this radio station. It's a tough problem, and there are a couple things I need to address with you about this. One is, I'm going to say that we don't really know what all the long-term side effects are. So we know that there are short-term side effects like the blood clots and things along those lines. The issue of stroke and cardiac risk is really not well defined yet. There have been some studies that suggest cardiac risk. There are other studies that suggest cardiac protection as far as heart attack goes. So I'm going to say that we really don't know what that answer is long term. Again, I go back to what I said earlier. I'm a symptom guy. If, you know, at 160, excuse me, you are likely going to have symptoms. You're probably going to have some lack of energy, maybe some decreased libido, other symptoms associated with it, the muscle mass you talked about. The muscle mass is not something that I personally dwell on with patients a lot, but the other symptoms really are, because those are life-changing symptoms. You can take a guy who's very tired, give him some testosterone replacement, and really change the way he interacts with the world. So at 160, you probably have symptoms. You probably will benefit from treatment. So to answer your question, the topicals are great if they're doing the trick for you and if they're cost effective. If not, there are compounded topicals. I kind of mentioned that before. There are shots. You can give yourself injections of the testosterone. There are pellets. You can have pellets implanted in some fatty tissue in your buttocks that allow for kind of a long-term administration of testosterone. So there are a number of options out there. They all carry risk, though. So you really need to make sure you're having the discussion about what is your risk with producing clots versus, you know, your atrial fibrillation versus your symptom control. So you're in a not typical situation.
And the other problem I have is I travel constantly across the country, and we don't even have a home base, if you will, which makes it very hard for me to have a doctor that I can just go to readily and get into, okay, I'm going to give this to you now, come back in a month, and I'll check it again. Do you have any suggestions on how to handle that?
Yeah, you need to have somebody that follows you closely. I mean, yeah. you really do, because, you know, in this limited conversation, you've mentioned a couple things that are risk factors in terms of having problems and complications with testosterone replacement. So you really need to make sure that someone, you know, medically is on top of that for you, making sure that your risk is minimized and that your benefit is maximized.
So before I start the actual medication, I should get the physician where it can be monitored more closely.
I think that'd be a great idea, yeah. And you want to know what your numbers are also, because, you know, you really don't want to overshoot and put yourself at greater risk by you know, creating a testosterone level that's too elevated.
Okay, well, I sure appreciate your help, and thanks for having me on.
Steve, this is Dr. Brewer. Do you smoke?
No, I'm a non-smoker, non-drinker. I only cuss when I get really mad.
Okay. And your travel, are you sitting, like, in airplanes or in cars for long periods of time?
I travel by vehicle most of the time. In fact, I'm heading from Texas to Florida right now, and I've made this trip twice in the last 10 days.
Okay. Well, you know, I think most doctors would recommend, you know, all of the vascular risk factors, smoking, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, any risk for diabetes, things along those lines, all of the vascular risk factors, including family history, which is extremely important. You want to make sure that you, you know, put that into the equation when you're, you know, looking at your risk of having a cardiac event with any, you know, new medical treatment. So we wish you the best. Thanks so much for calling tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Barrow, you know, I guess it was probably 30 or 40 years ago now, estrogen replacement was extremely popular. And then we learned over time that women who were supplemented with estrogen, they were having more strokes and more cardiac morbidity, and actually increased risk of certain cancers, breast cancer, uterine cancer, and so forth. Can you talk a little bit about that, what that experience was with us, and is this something that we could see potentially coming into modernity, if you will, with testosterone replacement? Is that something that could happen to us again as a culture?
Sure. First off, when you talk about hormone replacement therapy, the main two hormones are estrogen and progesterone, like we talked about earlier. The first question that you have to ask a woman is, does she have a uterus? A woman with a uterus in place should not have estrogen therapy alone. If they're postmenopausal and you give them what we call unopposed estrogen, you put them at an increased risk for endometrial cancer. So that is just absolutely something that we should not do. If they do not have a uterus, they've had a hysterectomy, then you can do estrogen therapy alone. So most of the data on the risk of hormone replacement therapy goes back to the Women's Health Initiative, which was a large study on nurses. Now, the caveat to the study was that the study was mainly done in women that were past menopause. A lot of these women were older age. But the key take-homes from the study and what we still use to counsel patients on and what's still taught in medical school is that the main risk of hormone replacement therapy of both combined therapy and estrogen alone are the risk of stroke and venothromboembolism, which would be like a blood clot in the leg that could migrate to the lungs. In estrogen therapy, in combined therapy, the added risk of breast cancer and heart disease. The Women's Health Initiative arm, the combined therapy arm, was actually stopped because of the increased risk of breast cancer and heart disease. Now, the big thing with the counseling of the risk of these risk factors is you have to put it in perspective for women. The absolute increase in risk is actually very small. And what I tell patients is every medication, every treatment comes with a risk and a benefit, and they just have to look at their own symptoms, just as we discussed about the testosterone, and decide if those risks are worth it to them. If you have a woman that's coming in and she's having 15 to 20 hot flashes a day, waking up at night and having to change the bed sheets because of sweating and things like that, then you know those risks are minimal to them.
Tammy, we had a question that was submitted. What things can a woman do to prevent hot flashes? Perhaps someone who is nearing the age of menopause, but they have not reached the symptomatic level yet. And are there any natural supplements that can help?
There are a lot of natural supplements that are out right now. And you can go to your local health food store and things. And a lot of times they have people there that you can talk to and ask. But people that are looking for natural remedies, they're not regulated or anything, but there are some women that do get relief from them and do quite well with natural supplements and remedies.
Which ones in particular?
It's lost me. There's one that, can you help me? There's one that's over the counter.
Black cohosh.
Yeah, black cohosh, but there is one that has like six things in it. It has black cohosh as one of the things in it, and I can't think of it, but it's real popular right now in my mind.
And DHEA, do you see women using that? Have you found that to be helpful for women?
With DHEA, that's kind of another hormone now that's kind of controversial. For some, I will check a DHEA level because it works with our adrenals, but only if it's really low will I recommend that they try supplementing it to see if it helps with their symptoms like fatigue, things like that. I haven't had a lot of women have success with it, so I don't utilize it a lot, but I will check that for women.
This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. I'm your host tonight. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. Our topic is menopause, and in men, it's also known as andropause. The number here is 1-800-552-8502. We have three guests tonight. We have Dr. James Barrow with the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology here at LSU in Shreveport. We have Dr. Lauren Smith, urology at Piermont with the Willis-Knighton Health System, and Ms. Tammy Herkey, a nurse practitioner with the Hormone and Specialty Center here in Shreveport. The number here again for your calls, it's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet us a question at RRR Public Radio. So, Dr. Barrow, when we were talking to some of the callers about testosterone, a couple of different ways of giving testosterone were mentioned. Are there various ways of giving, replacing estrogen or estrogen and progesterone in a woman?
Sure. There's an oral form. There are topicals, and it just depends. The cheapest form would be estradiol, which you can get. That's actually on the Walmart $4 plan. So, and when patients have insurance issues or funding issues, that's always a good choice.
Okay. Other avenues as well, patches as well?
Sure. There's patches, injectables, all the same routes of as testosterone.
Dr. Smith, how often does one have to do the testosterone injections if they elect to go that route?
It really varies. Excuse me. It really varies by the patient. I usually start men out on about every 2 weeks. So I use a fairly standard dose. Have them give themselves the injection, do that every 2 weeks for about a month or so, have them come back, see what their levels are, and see how their symptoms are.
So this is sort of a depot testosterone, or is it standard?
I think I don't know that I would, I'm not sure. I wouldn't call it depot.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's an intramuscular injection. I think it gets absorbed over time.
Okay. Tammy, what about estrogen cream used locally? Do you find that effective in women?
Yes. There's prescription strength estrogen cream, and then you can also have it compounded. And that can work very well for women, and they'd have to apply it every day.
And what are the best symptoms to use that cream for?
I would say vaginal dryness and hot flashes.
We have another caller. We have Nick from Shreveport. Nick, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
I appreciate you taking my call. I'm sorry I got into the discussion a little late, and you may have already discussed this. But the two questions I had, I know you've discussed testosterone as hormone replacement therapy up to now. Have you any of the supposed natural testosterone boosters that make you produce more on your own? Is there any efficacy to them at all?
Dr. Smith, natural boosters.
I have no experience with them, so I really don't know. Really? I'm sorry.
That's fine. You hear a lot of claims. I appreciate the show. Thank you, folks.
Thank you so much, Nick, for calling Health Matters tonight. This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. The number is 1-800-552-8502. We have an abundance of callers regarding testosterone. It's a hot topic, but let's move forward with some of the risks of therapy. We mentioned the risks of replacing estrogen in women with a uterus that has to be opposed, if you will, by progesterone. Dr. Smith, what are the risks in terms of carcinogenesis or producing cancer in men who are supplemented with testosterone?
That's a great question. Prostate cancer is really what you're asking about, and prostate cancer is a hormonally driven cancer. And what I mean by that is basically the male body produces testosterone. It gets changed a couple times into a substance that then acts on the prostate on cancer to cause it to grow. Testosterone itself does not cause cancer. So if we replace testosterone, we're not going to cause prostate cancer. the way I talk about this with patients is, if you got a campfire and you've got a bunch of wood next to it, if you're throwing the wood in the campfire, you're causing a problem. Well, the wood would be the testosterone, the campfire would be the prostate cancer. If you don't have a campfire, that bundle of wood's not going to do anything except sit there. So it's not going to cause cancer unless you've got the cancer there, and then it will promote it and make it worse.
Yeah, and this whole issue with prostate cancer, I know it can be quite difficult to really sort out, you know, how do we screen for it? When we find it, how do we treat it? And so in men, it's been said that if a man lives long enough, he will get prostate cancer, and that most men will most likely die from something else if they get prostate cancer at an older age. And so have they done any natural history studies to look at men who develop prostate cancer while they're on testosterone? Do they tend to have a more aggressive form of the disease, or is it the normal prostate cancer that they would have gotten anyway?
There is an association between low testosterone levels and the diagnosis of prostate cancer. So men that come in for evaluation and have a low testosterone level are potentially more likely to be diagnosed with prostate cancer at some point. I don't know of studies that have looked at the question that you're asking in terms of, does the testosterone replacement make the cancer worse? There has been some work done with finasteride, which is a medicine which basically blocks testosterone, and the results suggest that it protects men from the diagnosis of prostate cancer, meaning that it lowers the risk. So men, say, age 50 or 55 or older who start the medication are going to be less likely to be diagnosed with that cancer. However, there is a suggestion in the data that they may be diagnosed with a higher grade or a more aggressive prostate cancer. I'm going to tell you, I'm not sure that the data is clear on that. I just don't know what to think about that completely myself.
Yeah, we really need the equivalent of the Women's Health Study, I think, to sort this issue out. Because if it is true that most men are going to get prostate cancer if they live long enough, and most men are going to stay on testosterone if they get on it, then what's going to happen when they do get prostate cancer, assuming that a lot of men will? So I think the data is out. It's a good discussion to have. I think we need to, you know, keep an eye on the ball in terms of, you know, what the safest thing is for that.
You're right.
We have another caller. We have Bess. Bess, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
Yes. And am I talking to Dr. This is Bess, and I just called, and I wanted to know who I was talking to.
This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. There are this is Dr. Okay. Randall Brewer. I'm the host. We have
okay.
three guests tonight.
Okay, because they mentioned a doctor, and so I was just seeing if I had his name right. And that's Brew, B-R-R.
Well, we have Dr. Barrow, an obstetrician from LSU. We have Dr. Lauren Smith, and we have Tammy Herkey, a nurse practitioner. Do you have a question for us?
Yes, sir, I do. Actually, I'm 73 years old, and I'm in the body and physically and mentally kind of a person that's a lot younger, very energetic. And I just had a lumpectomy because I had a lump that developed in my left breast. And then when the doctor went in, he kind of saw something on the periphery, and he needed to go back in again. And he saw that the precursor, I suppose, is the best lay term that I can use to cancer. It was a precursor to cancer. It wasn't because it was localized and it hadn't invaded or anything like that. So he went and took that out, the other whatever material or whatever he saw, tissue parts, as well. So I had a pretty serious, for me, surgery procedure, because one right after the other one, four days after the other one. And I, right now, I'm healing up really well, and I do heal very quickly whenever I've had a wound or anything. And so I'm just confused now with my life, because I retired a few years ago, and now I'm on land that I abandoned when I was very young, and I promised my papa I'd come back to it and develop it, and I want to come back and work. But I just don't know what I can do, and I don't know if, I heard you say that if you've had a complete hysterectomy, that you can have estrogen. And I just want to try and safeguard myself because I practice kind of biofeedback. I think that I'm a fairly healthy person, but there are some symptoms of things since I've had the surgery that are baffling me. And I probably need to either come into Shreveport and talk to a doctor there that's do what you all are doing and discuss. I have primary doctor, and I have the surgeon and established at LSU. And so, you know, I'm okay medically with doctors and people, but sometimes just talking to people who are educators, in other words, giving good information to people. So that's what I need, to know how I can get on an estrogen program or something that's going to keep my tissue developing normally, and how I can be in my best health where I am right now, fighting cancer with the radiation treatments. I've gone through a few of those, and I still have many of them to go through daily, if you're familiar with that process, that if the cancer did reoccur back in your breast area or whatever, that it wouldn't stand a chance with the radiation. And so I'm just a little bit out of sorts, not knowing what to do, but I would like some information on whatever can hopefully help me to stay with this youthful energy that I have.
Okay, Bess, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight. Dr. Barrow, you know, this is a really, really important subject, you know, a history of a breast mass, maybe breast cancer, and estrogen replacement.
Absolutely contraindicated.
Okay, that was a short answer.
Easy answer.
Easy answer. We have another question, Dr. Smith. A caller wants to know if men with high testosterone levels live shorter lives. And I'm assuming, you know, normal physiologic levels maybe later in age. Do you know of any data regarding high testosterone levels and shorter lives?
I really don't know of any. You know, most of the data regarding what we consider normal levels are actually have been developed in men over age 60 or 65, and so the numbers may be skewed and not be, again, not necessarily represent what we know as being a normal value. Abnormally high values, we worry about other disease processes. There are some tumors that can make testosterone, etc. But in terms of normal physiologic high levels of testosterone over age, it probably allows men to have improved muscle mass, potentially keeps them from being depressed, may increase libido over time. But as far as longevity, I don't know of any data.
And we know, I mean, the risk of maybe aggression and maybe risk-taking, you
sure
think might be there?
Sure.
Okay. Tammy, we have another question that was submitted. About what age does menopause start, and how long does it last?
Menopause, the average age is 51. How long it lasts, the true diagnosis of menopause is no cycle in 12 months, no menstrual cycle in 12 months is the definition. So however old you are when that occurs, the hard thing is there's women who go into the perimenopausal phase, which could start in their early 40s, where their hormones are up and down, and that can last 10 years. So it's very vague and very different with each patient.
Yeah, and I was reading and before the show, It can happen quickly. You can have sort of a crash in hormones, or it can happen very, very slowly over time. Does that have any influence on how long it lasts in terms of how long it takes a woman to actually develop menopause?
You have some women that will just stop bleeding, and they're lucky that don't have any symptoms, and all of a sudden a year went past and they didn't even realize it. Those are the lucky ones. And then you have the ones who miss cycles, start having symptoms, and it waxes and wanes, and then they think they went through, and then boom, here comes another cycle. So there's just a roller coaster of everything, with hot flashes and mood swings and not sleeping because they're hot, which causes irritability, which can cause mood changes, which can cause everything.
Dr. Barrow, you know, the previous caller had a contraindication to estrogen replacement therapy. And let's say, hypothetically, you know, there are symptoms related to menopause in that individual. And so how could we symptomatically treat a patient who cannot get estrogen replacement?
So there are other options. The caveat to that is that all the other options in head-to-head studies with hormone replacement therapy don't work as well. That being said, there are several other FDA-approved options, such as SSRIs or antidepressants, clonidine, which is an old antihypertensive, gabapentin, which is an anticonvulsant, some of these have data to support their use, and but again, head-to-head with hormone replacement therapy, none of them work as well.
Would topical, let's say for vaginal dryness, would estrogen cream place a woman with a history of breast cancer at risk for worsening the cancer if she just elected to do that for local symptom control?
That there's probably not good data to support that. However, the FDA warning is no estrogen replacement in women with a history of personal breast cancer. So you just kind of have to take that on a symptom basis and a patient-by-patient basis. But it's not outside the realm of being outside the standard of care or anything like that.
This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. The topic is menopause and in men and women, or also known as andropause in men. The number for your questions, it's 1-800-552-8502. Our guest tonight, Tammy Herkey, nurse practitioner here in Shreveport with the Hormone and Specialty Clinic. We have Dr. Lauren Smith, urology at Piermont, and Dr. James Barrow from the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology here at LSU School of Medicine in Shreveport. We have another caller. Greg, thanks for calling Health Matters tonight.
Thank you. My wife recently had a full hysterectomy where they removed the uterus and both ovaries. She was having issues with those. But since the hysterectomy, of course, her hormone levels have been all over the place. Is it normal for a woman going through the menopausal stages to start lactating on a regular basis?
Greg, thank you so much. That's a very interesting question. Let's pose it to the panel. So surgical menopause, I'm assuming, Dr. Barrow, would you expect some hormonal fluctuations fairly quickly after, obviously after the ovaries are removed?
Yes, you can have symptoms. A woman can have symptoms immediately post-op, even up to seeing them the day after hysterectomy.
What about lactation?
That is regulated by a different hormone, but also comes from the pituitary, which is influenced by the estrogen and progesterone hormones. So I have never seen that personally, and that may be unrelated.
Right. I would think maybe an endocrinologist might need to get in.
Yeah, I would definitely say.
Check prolactin levels, maybe MRI of the brain, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Tammy, Greg, thank you so much for calling us tonight.
Thank you.
Tammy, we have a question. How long into menopause is a woman still fertile and still need birth control methods?
With that, they would check the follicle-stimulating hormone, and if it's greater than 25-30, depending on the lab, usually they're not fertile at that point.
Okay, so not very long at all, huh? So, again, this is Health Matters on Red River Radio. Our topic is menopause, and the topic of surgical menopause was just brought up by one of our callers. Tammy, let's say, for example, a woman has decided to have a complete hysterectomy, which would mean the removal of the uterus and the ovaries, and she's going to go through menopause on an iatrogenic basis. How would you approach hormone replacement in that individual, and what sort of discussion does she need to have with her physician before she has the operation about, you know, the surgical menopause that's going to occur?
That's a very interesting question. My view on this is kind of out there. I would love all women to have a baseline hormones in their 20 when they feel fabulous. I want to know where they are so that I can kind of later when that occurs, because usually if someone's thinking about having a hysterectomy, she's already in the perimenopausal phase, she's already having symptoms, she's not feeling that good, she's on a roller coaster. So those labs will help, but not as good as somebody in their 20s. I'd like their thyroid and hormone levels checked in their 20s. But I have patients that come and see me prior to hysterectomies. I get a baseline so I know where they are. On the day that they have their labs done, I get a system check where I check exactly how they felt on that day. And then after their hysterectomy, depending on how old they are, any risks of breast cancer, things like that, determines how I treat or related to the hormone replacement afterwards.
And so, Dr. Barrow, in an individual who has undergone a hysterectomy, let's say a younger woman who's undergone a hysterectomy with removal of the ovaries as well, do you normally replace them with estrogen until they're at the age at which they would normally go through menopause?
So,
seems like a lot of women are having hysterectomies in their 40s these days, and so they've decided maybe surgically to for birth control methods or abnormal uterine bleeding. Or
typically, we try to the current recommendations that are leave the ovaries in place until they're actually closer to menopause. So these days, you'll see less and less women having early hysterectomies in their 30s and early 40s that are actually having their ovaries taken, unless they've had some kind of problem like the last caller was talking about. But if you do take them out in a younger woman, they benefit greatly from hormone replacement therapy. The FDA guidelines on hormone replacement therapy in a patient like this, or even a patient you start in the perimenopausal period, is undefined. You basically start that patient, you treat the symptoms, and you treat them for as long as they feel comfortable and you feel comfortable. And at some undefined period of time, it's recommended that you titrate the dose down and see if they tolerate it. And if they do, the recommendations are just to keep them on hormone as sort of a bridge to overcome their symptoms, whether it be after hysterectomy or around the age of 51 when they're going through menopause.
Does family history of, let's say, uterine cancer, obviously not applicable in a woman having a hysterectomy, but let's say a family history of breast cancer, does that influence your decision in terms of the duration of treatment or maybe monitoring for breast cancer as they get older if they are replaced with estrogen?
So the only contraindication to hormone replacement therapy in terms of breast cancer is a personal history of breast cancer. A patient that has had a close family member with breast cancer, and you tell them about the risk of increased breast cancer, say with combined therapy, in my experience, and Tammy can probably speak to this even more than me, is that they're not going to choose that option. They're going to choose one of the other options just because they've seen and lived through somebody else with cancer. But it is not a contraindication with a family history of breast cancer to take hormone replacement therapy.
Tammy, do you know, is there a risk, let's say a woman who's got a first-degree relative, mother or sister, with breast cancer, we won't go into the gene, but let's just say, a strong family history, and they've had surgical menopause or they're having natural menopause, what do you counsel them regarding, the breast cancer issue with that?
With each woman, it's their choice. I mean, and it's very controversial because you'll have women who their lives are disrupted. They feel horrible. They come in and they They want to feel better. They want to, so they're coming to me for guidance on what to do because they don't like their life right now because they feel so bad. So we counsel, we talk about everything. And what my women, the women that see me, what their response is, I would rather live 15 years and feel good than live 20 and feel like I do right now. It's hard to explain because there's no real research that you can pull and say what's, you know, if there's a family history or not. It has to be their choice, and it has to be, you know, they know that the risk of cancer is there. So it's more of how they live their lives.
Do you recommend that they increase their level of surveillance for breast cancer if they choose to feel better now?
Always, always. People that have a strong family history, a mother that died, close relative, I'll even recommend that they get established with a breast specialist just so they're already established. And if they notice any change with their breasts, that's something going on, that they let somebody know and they be evaluated, because early detection is the number one thing with breast cancer.
We have another question that was submitted in, and I'm glad this one was submitted because we almost didn't get to it. What about bioidentical hormones? And I think maybe, you know, with mentioning some of the lab values that you obtain, you may have alluded to this, but is this something that you use typically?
I use everything because I have found that if I wouldn't use Premarin, there's some women that use well with Premarin, which I know is not bioidentical, but I use creams, I use injections, I use hormone pellets, I use, you name it, I use it. So there's a ton of information on bioidenticals. There's creams you have to use every day. For women, I do hormone injections, which are once a month, and then hormone pellets, which I do, they last 4 to 6 months. And those are more considered bioidentical.
Okay, very good. Dr. Smith, another question that was submitted is regarding, are there any natural ways to avoid the drop in testosterone or to boost one's own testosterone, whether it's through a certain type of exercise or a certain type of diet? Maybe, you know, there's a lot of emphasis maybe on, you know, high protein diets or maybe avoiding diets that are high in fat. Do you know of any information that supports that theory that dietary restrictions and different types of exercises can mitigate the effects of testosterone dropping over time?
I think to answer the question, I'm going to start by talking about a couple of the diseases that are related to low testosterone, specifically hypertension, high blood pressure, and hypercholesterolemia or high cholesterol. Diabetes is related, obesity. So I think that anything that you can do to counter those will help. Exercise is obviously good. But those are probably the main things.
Main things. So high protein diets and, you know, building muscle mass, does that mitigate? It may have an effect, so it might help if men are leery about replacing their testosterone right away. Maybe an increased exercise program may be a benefit. Okay, very good. Thanks to our guest tonight, Dr. James Barrow from the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology here at LSU in Shreveport. Dr. Lauren Smith, thank you so much for coming back to Health Matters tonight. And Tammy Herkey from the Hormone Specialty Center here in Shreveport, thank you so much for joining us tonight. As you know, Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or a healthcare professional. Production of Health Matters is made possible in part by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and also by the Gables at Spring Lake, Gamble Guest Care's assisted living community located behind Spring Lake Guest Care. Learn more at gambleguestcare.com. Please join us next week. The topic will be pornography. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us tonight on Health Matters.